that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Sounds really disbelieving. What the heck that could be? Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they stayed in the exact same spot
all
time. They're
out
there, like
say that. Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Marlisa, are you ready for this?
My cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange days indeed. Most peculiar, Mama.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello and welcome to program 450 in the current series of Strange Days Indeed. Can't believe it, 450 programs over the last 9 years. On the program this time, Dave Verlott with his take on it, an update on last year's Chicago O'Hare International UFO by Don Ledger. NARCAP published a report on that incident, and we'll discuss that with Don. And a moment I never thought I would hear, actually several moments, Paul Kimball, documentary maker, and Alfred Lemberg discuss various things about ufology, including Paul's appearance with his documentary at the recent X conference in a suburb of Washington, D.C. All of those people coming up on this edition, 450 of Strange Days Indeed.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Verlott.
Is ufology anti-science? That's the post that has been going on for some time now on the UFO updates list, and many people have weighed in on the discussion, including some real scientists in the ufological community like Stanton Friedman. Now, the post attacks the very heart of ufology and ufologists by posing the first question as to whether ufology, the study of UFOs, is a science or a pseudoscience. Now, to be fair in this situation, pseudoscience is any body of knowledge, methodology, belief, or practice that claims to be scientific or is made to appear scientific but does not adhere to the basic requirements of the scientific method. And the scientific method is a body of techniques for investigating phenomena, acquiring new knowledge, or correcting and integrating previous knowledge based on gathering observable, empirical, and measurable evidence subject to specific principles of reasoning. The scientific method consists of the collection of data through observation and experimentation and the formulation and testing of hypotheses. Now, those definitions are from the online encyclopedia known as Wikipedia. And when you finally uncross your eyes and brain from deciphering them, it all boils right back down to whether ufology is a pseudoscience. Many claim that it is, simply based on the absence of obtaining something that is measurable or capable of us doing some experimentation. It's real simple. We don't have a ship, a pilot from a ship, an ashtray from some downed UFO, or even a hunk of heat shield, or even some space dust they picked up along the way to play with. Or do we? Several countries have been accused of collecting and gathering up a crashed UFO and squirreling it away from prying eyes, particularly the prying eyes of ufologists. So in black and white, no measurable evidence means there's no scientific method, which means it's a pseudoscience. And if it's a pseudoscience, it must be, by all definition, an anti-science. Right? Wrong. For decades now, every ufologist I know of has been begging to have ufology investigated by scientists. And some brave scientists have come forward and done everything they can to gather, prepare, and present evidence that proves UFOs exist. They are real, and our planet is being visited on a pretty regular basis. The sad thing is that some of those scientists have suffered as a result of their hard work, suddenly losing their grants for scientific study, or their jobs at facilities of higher learning, or simply being ostracized by the scientific community for their efforts. All of that means that anyone who thinks about investigating UFOs has to think twice, and they have to weigh the consequences of their actions against the consequence of inaction. To me, it boils down to a measure of bravery. And what that bravery means is that every scientist that ventures forth to investigate ufology needs to be welcomed. They need to be welcomed with open arms by all of us that have an interest in the field. And don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about scientists that have their mind made up already in either direction. The scientists that begin examining what they have with the mindset that UFOs are real and they're going to prove it are just as dangerous as the ones that think it is all hogwash and they are going to prove their belief. Yes, that's right. I said belief. To my way of thinking, a true scientist is going to set out to simply prove or disprove a hypothesis, and they are completely open-minded to getting a negative result. No, ufology is not anti-science. If anything, the hard work done and being done by hundreds and sometimes thousands of people over the decades proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that ufology truly is a science that is working hard to gain acceptance by the scientific community at large. Groundwork has been laid and slowly is being built upon that proves that UFOs do exist. The only question that needs to be proven at this time is, what are UFOs? But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
And I can hear the many hands clapping. Nicely put, Dave.
Thank you.
I think there are far too many scientists, and we've discussed this many times on this program before, there are far too many scientists who are happy just to ignore what it is that's going on around them and focus on maintaining their funding and maintaining their tenure.
Exactly. Position, tenure, funding.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of they're looking at the consequences. If they come forward and try and investigate, they're putting their neck on the line. If they do nothing, then there's no consequence. So it's easy for them to sit back and say, yeah, let somebody else do it.
Yeah.
What we have to do as a community is every one of them that does take that step forward, we have to welcome them. Even if we disagree with something that they say or something that they're thinking, we still have to welcome them because it gets us a step further.
Does that include people like Michael Sala?
Oh, wow.
Exopolitics?
Oh, no. We have to be wary of the scientists that already have their mindset made up in one particular area.
Well, yes.
And aren't willing to listen to reason.
Mm-hmm. And that boils back to Stanton T. Friedman's investigation by proclamation.
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't know what you're talking about, shut up, Stan says.
He's right on. And he's one of the scientists within the ufological community that's just done amazing work.
I can think of almost a dozen scientists
mm-hmm.
who've done amazing work around the field.
Ted Phillips. Trace evidence that they go out and gathering. People investigating crop circles at the scientific level,
mm-hmm.
right down to the gene structure of the bloody plants.
Nancy Talbot and Levengood.
Yes, Levengood and Talbot basically get right down and dirty in the scientific evidence of what happens in crop circles, determining whether or not they can be done here on this planet with stuff that we have.
Mm-hmm. And apparently the changes in the plants, we can't do that because it requires temperatures of 800 degrees for us to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that we subject to 800 degrees Fahrenheit is not going to leave much of the plant.
That's right.
If anything at all, other than a little pile of gray ash.
And that's part and parcel of it. We have these scientists that are doing that work. That is the groundwork. That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Which proves beyond a shadow of a doubt, in my mind, UFOs exist. End of statement on that one. What they are, however, is what's up for question. Because we're not sure. They could be coming from another planet. They could be coming from another dimension. They could be anything. Another time, even.
Yeah.
We just simply don't know what they are. They exist. There's no question. UFOs exist. Anybody with a functioning brain that looks even just at a little of the evidence has to believe that.
Well, has to know that.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference between belief and knowing.
Yes, that's true.
There are a lot of us who've had very strange experiences.
Mm-hmm.
We are not believers, we are knowers.
Yeah, we've seen it firsthand. Like my experience last summer, I know what I saw was a UFO.
Did we talk about that on this program?
We've touched briefly on it, I think.
Well, so tell us what you saw, Dave.
Basically, it was a situation where I came home, and what I saw was a light that varied in intensity. This was broad daylight. And it moved very slowly, and basically it winked out. It vanished. I've seen aircraft lights. I've seen aircraft coming into Pearson, and seen aircraft coming into Buttonville with their landing lights on. This was not an aircraft with a landing light on.
Wasn't reflection off an aircraft, and when it turned, the reflection disappeared.
No. This was definitely something that was not an aircraft, not a helicopter, it wasn't a plane, and it was also moving in a different direction than it would be if it was coming in on a landing or a takeoff from either Pearson or Buttonville. I immediately ruled those out one by one as I was watching this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a situation where it literally disappeared. And we're talking broad daylight.
Yeah.
And we're talking a cloudless sky.
Tom Theophanis had a sighting himself last summer, too.
Mm-hmm.
On his way to pick up Lise, his wife, going north on the 400, almost at Canada's Wonderland, for people who don't know. It's your basic theme park. He had a sighting of a very strange object. He kept it inside as he went north of the theme park, pulled into where his wife works and wanted her to come out and take a look. And by the time he got her outside, it was gone. Tom is a very smart investigator. He was head of investigation for MUFON Ontario. So he did ask himself all the right questions as he was seeing it.
That's the part and parcel of it all. And it's interesting the effect that it has on us. Because as I was watching this thing, I was basically saying, okay, I know it's not that. I know it's not that. I know it's not that. As you get further and further down the list, and it'll start eliminating stuff, you're going, oh, boy.
My first sighting.
Yeah, sort of type thing.
And a daylight sighting.
Yeah, and a daylight sighting at that.
For both of you.
So it's sort of like, whoa, okay.
Oh, just another mystery.
Oh, yeah.
We're getting used to those, though, aren't we? Maybe a little too used to them.
We have so many mysteries within this field. It just boggles the mind to think of all of them. They just keep being added to. We can't get the answers, unfortunately, on probably, 90% of the bona fides? There's still all kinds of theories being tossed out there, but we really can't say for sure.
Not being able to say for sure is, I think, where we'll leave it this
mm-hmm.
time, Dave Verlot.
We have to.
Yeah. Yes, we do. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Talk to you next time.
For sure.
Dave Verlot. DaveForLot.com. Ooh.
That gives me impetus. As soon as I get my new system up and running, that's going to be my first project.
So DaveFerlot.com is the place to go, and talk to you next time.
For sure.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Don Ledger is a fairly frequent contributor to this program on matters aviational. He's the Canadian representative up here in Canada for the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. And a few weeks ago, NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena, published its findings on the Chicago O'Hare International Airport UFO back in November of 2006. A long document, eh, Don Ledger?
Approximately 152 pages, Errol, of information regarding that particular incident under the auspices of the chief scientist there, Dr. Richard Haynes, formerly of NASA Ames at Moffett Field in Washington State. He spent probably about 6 months on this, along with some other people, and brought together all of the information that each person was working on into the report. It's fairly comprehensive. It probably answers some questions and asks some questions as well.
A lot of technical reports in there. And I must point out that you spent a lot of time putting it together in its present state as a PDF file, as well as contributing to the report, I believe, on the radar facilities at O'Hare.
I had very little to do with the radar. That was Martin Schuff from Great Britain. I did do the PDF. My contribution was towards the end, explaining what, if pilots were coming in or leaving from O'Hare, or any airport for that matter, the workload that would be present at the time, stressing that there being such a workload that to acquiesce to some anomalous phenomena going on at the airport would be a big deal, you know, to drag them away from their workload, particularly on landing. That's when the pilot is the busiest. It would be quite a big deal for them to take the time to make note of it and report it, if indeed it was reported. We don't know for sure that that actually happened. Maybe we should give everybody a bit of a brief thumbnail update of what actually happened there. According to the NARCAP report, it was first noted by an air traffic controller, not necessarily seen from tower, but there was conversation about it over a half an hour before the actual incident, which is quite odd. This wasn't known when the report was first begun. At about 2 minutes to four. Now, the main activity seems to have taken place, a little bit of a flurry that went on, at about 4:30 in the afternoon. This is 32 minutes after an air traffic controller was speaking about it. So somebody noticed it before then. You know, one thing that's important about this particular report that sort of gets sloughed over, nobody pays much attention to it, the cloud base. The cloud base was an absolute 1,900 feet. All right, and that was measured by what's called a celiometer. They don't use weather balloons around these airports anymore, not at the big ones. Too dangerous to have these things floating around in the same airspace with 100 airplanes buzzing around. So they use laser celiometers, and not only will it measure the first cloud base, but it'll measure the second one and the third one above that, too. And this one was measured as absolute at 1,900 feet. So you've got an absolute bottom to this thing. This was solid all over the airport. So now the object was suspected to being at between maybe 1,500 to 1,800 feet in the air. I always place great importance on that cloud base because now we know the altitude, which is not very high. With people that are used to looking at airplanes and so on, that's nothing. Over any busy airfield, you know, 1,800 feet is quite low.
So there you have this disc hanging out of the United Airlines terminal building at the second busiest airport in North America, if not the world.
In the world.
Concourse C of United Airlines Terminal. It's hanging in the sky up there. Air traffic control has seen it. There's been discussion about it for at least a half an hour before it was finally spotted, which is bizarre to me, by a mass of witnesses.
This information, of course, didn't come out until later on, but a maintenance man with United Airlines who was taxiing a 747. Now, this guy had been working there for 30 years. He was a highly qualified individual. He was one of the first to notice it while he was taxiing the airplane by looking up through the window.
So he must have got on ground control frequency and told somebody, because the word got around. Another handler who had his headset plugged into the nose of another aircraft he was working at one of the other gates looked up and he saw it. And nearly a dozen people on the ground saw it. A supervisor came out after he was made aware of it. Somebody called on the company radio, which is not a public frequency, and he went outside and he saw it. He talked to the tower about it, who could not see it. This is sort of important. The fact that they couldn't see it. The FAA were aware of it. This was ongoing at the time. And then when it was first brought up, they denied anything had happened. And then when they were confronted with the evidence of their own reports and so on, well, it was weather phenomenon, which everybody, frankly, says is silly. And numbers didn't. But the other thing is, who in the FAA has the qualifications to say that it's weather phenomenon? They're not the U.S. Weather Office, and they can't make a claim like that just right off the cuff. It was just a spokesman for the FAA came out with this nonsensical explanation, which just didn't hold water at all. A considerable amount of investigation went on to see if it could have been seen by radar, which apparently it could not be seen by radar where it was. And this is very curious. It managed to pick the one spot on the airport that was blind to radar and the tower.
Isn't that peculiar?
Yeah, isn't it?
It puzzles me that there would be any blind spots in the air at 1,800 feet around Chicago O'Hare.
There is. They are air traffic controllers, but they're tower controlled, principally concerned with aircraft in their area that's coming in, and nobody's going to be coming in at 1,800 feet over the airfield unless they're vectored through there, and it's not likely going to be the case unless it was a helicopter being vectored through or something like that, and it would be vectored through, not hovering. Not only is that a good spot to hover, because of the way the cab is built on the tower, it sticks up there about 200 feet. It's very high. But because of the way the cabs are made in these towers to prevent glare and so on, that altitude, around 1,800 feet, in that particular area, keeps it away from any runways and also keeps it out of sight of the tower personnel, Chicago O'Hare Tower. I found that highly unusual, too. These things knew just where to park and stay out of harm's way and at the same time stay out of the tower's line of sight. And the only people that were going to see it were people directly below it on the ground. Or anybody else around the airport that was in, you know, a half mile would probably see the thing up there in the sky if they were looking. It was described as being lead and gray in color. Well, so what's a thick cloud base, you know, at 4:30 in the afternoon in November going to look like? It's almost dark by then, right? It was almost like camouflaging itself, except it didn't do a very good job because everybody could see it plainly from the ground, I guess. Years ago, I would have thought to myself, well, you know, that's just a little too much of a stretch. But if you keep seeing it over and over and over again, I don't mean particularly at an airport, it's these coincidences that happen, like these things just seem to be in the right place for certain people to see them and other people not to see them. You know yourself, Harold, that this pops up over and over and over again.
Indeed, and continues to puzzle. You said it was solid cloud at 1,900 feet.
Measured.
Absolute 1,900 feet. The object eventually punched a hole through that cloud, which hung around.